We abuse land because we regard it as a commodity belonging to us. When we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect. Aldo Leopold.
There's a new pet.
Chia.
Chia Pet, the pottery that grows. It's fun, easy, and educational. Just soak your chia overnight. Then spread the seeds like this. Keep it watered and watch it grow.
Chia.
And before you know it, your chia pets and trees will be green and beautiful for everyone to enjoy. And now grow a whole collection of fun with chia teddy bears, chia puppies, chia kittens, chia rams, chia bulls, and even beautiful chia trees to keep your pets company. Collect them all.
Chia.
Nice chia pet.
Chia pets and trees are fun for all ages and make a great gift. Just ask for
Chia.
Chia pets and trees. The pottery that grows.
Chia pets and chia trees are available at Wilco, Sellers, Kmart, Neiman's. Make the perfect gift. Chia pets and chia trees are available at McLeod's and participating home hardware and rural hardware stores.
I'm Jacob, and I'm a PhD candidate in the Department of Organismic and Evolutionary Biology at Harvard University.
Yeah, and I'm Ben, the other half of Let's Botanize, and I'm currently a postdoctoral researcher at Harvard University. Very recently, was a fellow PhD student with Jacob.
Let's Botanize. I'd love to know how you guys met each other, got into this, like, sort of sharing of information about plants, because it's a very, it seems very like a specific topic, the general public, you know, plants is a very complicated thing. And it's hard to, you know, I had the same, it's probably some similar problems that you guys had going into this, except I don't have any visuals that I can really give, you know? So it's like, I've always had the block of how am I going to do a podcast on plants? Because it's so, you know, it's so visual that it's going to be really difficult. And, you know, like where to start, like everyone's at sort of different levels of knowledge and how do you get these people interested in plants?
For sure. There's a lot of good stuff in there, but we could start with how we met. So Jacob and I were both PhD students at the same time at Harvard in the Department of Organismic and Evolutionary Biology. And we were in different labs, but both of our labs study plants sort of fundamentally from different angles. And maybe more importantly, or more significantly, both of our labs were based at the Arnold Arboretum, which is some convoluted thing. It's like technically owned by Boston. It's a public park, but it's leased back to Harvard for $1 a year, you know, this sort of thing. So it's both a public park of Boston that is free and open to the public, but houses research that is affiliated with Harvard University. So our labs were based out here in this little plant haven where we both are now actually talking to you from. And there's just a really great community of plant scientists out here. And we were both grad students at the same time, sort of in the process of wrapping that up now, but that's how we met. And Jacob, I don't know if you wanna add something.
Yeah, well, I guess the origin of the origin story of Let's Botanize. I think every sci-commer has their origin story, kind of like a superhero, I guess. So, you know, Ben and I bonded, I think, over our love for organisms, particularly our shared love and curiosity for plants. And because our lab is based at the Arnold Arboretum, and because of the like frequent stress of grad school, we found ourselves going on a lot of walks during the week, you know, when things got stressful. And we just also found ourselves bonding over like the plants that were around us. Like we'd look at buds of oaks or maples or Look at, you know, leaf venation or fruit and flower morphology, things like that. And then we started to like expand that from walks during the week into, you know, weekend hikes to maybe more exciting places or different places rather around Boston, the greater Boston area and Massachusetts. And after a while, you know, we were sitting down eating lunch, just like right outside of our lab space. And we were like, what if we just start recording, you know, videos and taking photos and kind of just documenting what we're doing, not with any real mission in mind, right? Just kind of, we are already doing this. Why don't we continue to do this in a fun and exciting way? And then that kind of snowballed into like, oh, okay, we can like actually impact people's lives maybe and share our passion for plants with people around the world. And then it kind of snowballed a bit more into, oh, I think we think we're doing something really big, which is what our mission is now, which is democratizing the study of plant biology, right? And so what we realized was like, there's this huge inequality that exists, particularly in specific academic disciplines. There's a limit on what people can learn without having access to the resources of a university. And so our goal with Let's Botanize is to provide those resources to people around the world with these, you know, short videos and thoughtfully produced, content. So that's kind of like our origin and direction and how it all started and where we are.
It's really exciting, you know, just to, I think there's a lot of space out there for more people to do things on plants. I just think it's an untapped market in a lot of ways. You know, like the houseplant market is probably oversaturated, but everything else is, you know, there's so many plants in the world and so much information to share.
That's a good point about the houseplants, but even that, I feel like in the last 2 years during the pandemic exploded into maybe starting to feel saturated now, but that's even really recent. I feel
you guys remember Chia Pets. That, you know, I was looking up plant commercials to see if I could find any, and the only one that comes up is Chia Pet. But I was thinking democratization of plants, and there's plenty of commercials about other things that people are selling, but nobody's really like, there's not really a lot of commercials besides Chia Pet.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
You know, where there was like a mass movement to sort of like sell plants to people.
Right.
And digging a little deeper into that, it was actually this, I forget what his last name was, but he actually went in the 70s, went to Mexico and saw Mexican artists using chia seeds in their art, similar to what, you know, Chia Pet is. And he basically took that, stole it, turned it into a business.
Mm-hmm.
He also invented the clapper. So if you remember that one, clap on, clap.
Oh, the clapping light. Oh,
yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Interesting.
Now it's a superfood that they sell for, you know, $10 a pound or something.
Two things that come to mind when you said that are like, one, there's like a history of, you know, bioprospecting and sort of like a colonial way, of course, that we definitely need to be aware of. But the other thing is like, yeah, how did that transition happen from Chia Pets to like this superfood that people put in their yogurts or like water and hydrate, you know? Kind of interesting, makes you think like, oh, did they just have an abundance of this after the Chia Pet boom? And they were like, how do we get rid of this?
Well, he does also sell it in bulk on whatever it's called, like something enterprise is the name of the business, but they sell Chia Pets and they sell it in bulk as a superfood.
Diversified.
They diversified, yes. I know you guys want to talk about the democratization of plants and information. I guess from my perspective, you know, going to a university and having access and then sort of getting cut off because I graduated. And so now, you know, it costs a lot of money to go through the paywall of universities and all of sort of the, what do they call it?
the journals, the publishing articles. Companies.
Yeah, peer-reviewed articles of, you know, actual studies that I might want to look at to get information that's not, you know, Google or on the internet. You know, and sort of either use that for my own knowledge or use that to figure something else out. So you guys probably aren't in that situation because you're still connected with the university, right? So you have access to that. But is there, are there sources out there that I can go to that, you know, would sort of give me the whole picture of information? I want? Sometimes you can look on Google, but it's very limited sometimes what you can get. You know, I can get an abstract, or, you know, sometimes I can't. Sometimes I can just read it, or I can get an article from like the 60s, you know, a peer-reviewed article from 40, 50 years ago that might not be accurate anymore.
This is a big conversation, even within academia, among institutions that have different size endowments, for instance, and can afford to subscribe to every journal versus only a certain subset. And so this conversation happens even within academia. And one of the things, it's a large conversation, and but we can touch on a couple of things maybe that come up. And one is that there has been, I feel like even since the time I started sort of seeking peer-reviewed articles as an undergrad, getting into research, and between that time and finishing my PhD, I feel like there's even been more and more momentum and emphasis on open access journals that are free and not behind the paywall. But that can only go so far. And there's other issues with that because someone has to pay to keep the publishing companies going. And it costs a lot of money actually to publish in an open access journal most of the time. So only certain people can even afford to publish it. So these problems sort of compound. But that is one, you know, avenue that would sort of free journal articles from the academic only context is if more people sought to publish in open access journals, which does feel like it's happening to some degree, but it's never going to completely solve this problem.
Yeah, I think, you know, and piggybacking off of Ben's point there, the issue with these open access journals is that you do have to, as the publisher, as the scholar who wants to have their journal, their manuscript published in that journal, has to pay. So you have these access barriers, right? This is sort of like a pay to play type framework, which creates inequality. There are a couple other avenues that people are using to put their science out there. So one are sort of these archive places. These like bio archive is one area. There's a lot of these spin-off. That's kind of like the biggest one. There's like med archive. There's a whole bunch of other different platforms where scholars will put their research up on those sites before it's technically published. And so that's one, and, you know, depending on how much it changes during the review process, those are still pretty good and valid and articles to read. It's just not formatted like a nice journal article. You kind of have to comb through it, and like the figures are usually not placed in the right spots. They're kind of always at the end. So it's a little bit of a hurdle, I guess, in terms of like navigating that article. There are two other things, two other ways that people or scientists and other scholars promote their work for free. And one is through something called ResearchGate. So it's kind of like the Facebook of science or whatever, where you know, you can put together a little profile, and then every time you have an article, you post the PDF on there, and you can either make it open to the public or you can make it private. But if it's private, usually you can just message the person and say, "Hey, can you send me your article?" And they are usually happy to do that. The last way that I've experienced and what I do personally is by putting up my PDFs for free on my personal website. So under my like research section, and many other people do this under their research section of their website. They'll sort of have links to their documents. I'm sure that there are some issues with that in terms of what the journal is okay with, but it happens on such a wide scale that, you know, it's pretty commonplace.
So what are you guys, doing research right now? What are you working on?
Yeah, I just ran out of the lab to to hop on this call, but so the lab that I'm in works on speciation, trying to understand how different lineages diverge to the point that we'd start describing them as two different species. And interesting. Specifically, our study system are the phlox, so P-H-L-O-X, it's a genus of herbaceous wildflowers from North America primarily. And there's about 60 or so taxa that have varying degrees of relatedness or ability to hybridize in nature. And there's some interesting stories with flower color changing to sort of alter pollinator behavior and affect how plants mate with each other. All kinds of interesting stories in this genus, and our lab just sort of picks out different stories that usually were identified by sort of natural history work. Hey, I think something evolutionarily interesting might be going on here, but they didn't follow it up with experimentation, or now we do a lot of genomic sequencing to try to understand evolutionary history. So that's the kind of stuff I'm preparing a big sequencing project right now for submission. So
that sounds cool.
Yeah. And I work on very different stuff to Ben and to the other folks in the Hopkins lab, which is the lab that Ben's a part of. So I'm much more organismal in the research questions I ask. So broadly I ask how plant traits are constructed, how they function, and how they have evolved across deep geologic time. And I use ferns as a study system to answer those questions. So Ben uses phlox with a PH, and I use ferns with an F. And over the last few years, I've really taken that framework and applied it to understanding the evolution of the plant vascular system. So essentially, the network and of tubes that help move water and nutrients through their body. You know, not dissimilar to our own vascular system. So I ask questions like, why do you have variation in the way you plumb your body as a fern? How has that variation evolved over their 400 million years of evolution?
Do you ever get overwhelmed with putting together videos? And
this is always fun. Let's botanize. I mean, by this, it's always fun. So
yeah,
if we're getting pretty stressed out by work, it's nice to take a weekend morning and go film a video or two. If Let's Botanize started feeling like grueling work, then yeah, it might get overwhelming, but so far it hasn't.
That's good. But so what are you guys seeing right now for spring ephemerals down there?
Well, so as you mentioned, this is like such an exciting time of year, and kind of, I think for us, like SciComers, at least plant SciComers, like a little bit overwhelming, right? Cause you're like, oh shoot, we had to get the sassafras flowers are popping out. We need to do something there. Like, oh, the lilacs which are not native, are starting to like pop out. And like, you know, maybe we need to like get on that and you know, all the little herbaceous monocots that are popping the little flowers up, things like that. Right now, you know, the maples are popping, the dogwoods are starting to bloom.
We're a little bit tree centric on our arboretum walks. Jacob and I just last weekend we led a tree, an early spring tree ID. Can't quite call it winter tree ID, an early spring tree ID walk. And one of the things that we got to take advantage of was some of the tree species, primarily the wind pollinated ones, are starting to flower, and you can use that to help you get to genus or species.
Yep. Yeah. It's always like, you know, when I see a countdown in Massachusetts, it's just a couple weeks off for me. Mm-hmm. You know, there were some, I saw some hazelnut flowers the other day. But I'm really, and I think out in Western Mass, I've seen people posting pictures of like spring beauties and things like that. So it's, it feels like it's been a really long winter. Even though we have snow, it was really cold. I mean, this, even this past week, it was, I woke up, it was 10 degrees here.
Yeah, we had the cold snap too. Not quite that cold, but
definitely I think a lot more things would be like active right now if it weren't for that like really cold last couple days. I think now it's like starting to warm back up and things are doing their thing. It's also been raining, you know, today and yesterday. So
that will pay in the off, next hopefully.
Yeah, next couple of weeks we'll start seeing some of these, you know, herbaceous ephemerals start to pop up.
More of
them. Yeah. That'll be fun. Well, I look forward to seeing them on your page. Jacob, did you just got back from the Everglades?
Mm.
And yes. Ben, did you go to the Everglades too?
Both guys? I wish. Oh. Yeah. Just Jacob on this trip.
Yeah. So we are, as we talked about in the beginning, we're both PhD candidates at Harvard. Ben actually just defended not too long ago, and I'm planning on defending soon. But as doctoral students, you have to teach courses as part of, you know, the degree program. Some people teach more courses than others. I kind of fall into that category of tending to teach a lot because I really love it. And so the course that I'm teaching now that I have taught in the past is plant diversity and evolution. And as part of that course, we have a spring break field trip that where we usually take the students to somewhere really tropical and interesting. So historically, we've gone to Brazil in a beautiful place called Chapada de Mancina, which is it's words can't describe how spectacular it is, but really diverse part of the world. And of course, COVID did not allow us to do significant international travel, especially with students, especially at Harvard, just because they're very strict with a lot of things. So instead, we decided to caravan down to, well, we flew. We took a trip down to southern Florida, which is so beautiful. And I mean, you know, it's one of the only, if not the only, truly tropical place in the continental United States. So it was so exciting to go down there and really show all the students some of the diversity in situ, right, in nature. And it was such a fun trip. Yeah, we went to the Everglades. We went to Big Cypress. We went to a couple of botanic gardens, including the Fairchild Botanic Garden. With a course like that, what's really exciting for me is to essentially like help the students curate their mental algorithm for identifying a plant when walking up to it, wherever they are. Right. And so, you know, that's sort of like taking this checklist of things, and helping them walk through it, right? How many petals, what's the calyx look like? How many stamens? Are the stamens attached to the petals? Are the petals fused? What does that mean for where we are in the broad phylogeny of flowering plants? Things like that. So, but yeah, it was very exciting. Lots of really cool plants to see down in southern Florida.
What was like the number one? Did you add anything? Do you have a plant list going, like a life plant list that you check things off of?
I don't, but that sounds exciting and maybe something I should definitely start.
It's a long list.
It is. Yeah, it'd be a long list. The thing that sticks out was that we saw a plant family called Theophrastaceae, which I was not familiar with. So that was that was wild. And really exciting for the students as well. But yeah, whether it's like my favorite or the one of the trip, not sure. Probably the other thing that sticks out was nuphar was flowering. We saw these water lily relatives, and those have really cool interesting flowers, and their biology and evolution is also really, really interesting. There are some of these, you know, what are called the early diverging angiosperms, or, you know, I'm putting for the listeners, I'm putting air quotes around that, just because, you know, they branched off from the phylogeny at the same time as everything else. So you don't want to talk about them as these like basal lineage. But anyway, it was really beautiful to see that in flower, you know, in nature. And yeah.
That we have those species of nuphar up here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, yellow ones, right?
Yeah, they're really pretty. They smell good. I think I've seen pink ones too. There's a pink one.
Oh, possibly. Interesting.
I always find new things that I want to find, or an iNaturalist helps with this because you can sort of like pinpoint where you want to check things out at some point. You know, but I'm always like, what are my hopeful plant sightings of in the next season as it comes around, you know, things I want to check out, go see. Do you guys want to say anything else about democratization of botany, plants, plant science?
Yeah, I think it's an exciting moment in terms of the interest is there. It feels like plants are cool to young people. I still feel kind of young, but there's definitely people younger than me who are out there starting to learn and figure out what they want to do with their lives and the types of things they want to be thinking about. And the brand of plants seems to be in a positive place right now for young generations. So now it feels like, okay, the goal is for those of us who have had access to like a pretty intense education in plant biology, can we keep that excitement up? Can we keep that interest up and keep pushing their curiosity further and further, and, you know, get some young people to commit to a career thinking about plants, and, or just, you know, even if it's not directly their career, just a lifetime of caring about plants and enjoying them.
Yeah. And even, you know, to that point, one might ask, why is it important to know about plants, right? Why is it important to care about plants? And so, you know, we think this mission is important, and because, I mean, plants are the foundation to nearly every ecosystem, right? And as we've said many times in many different ways, you know, they produce the oxygen we breathe, and the food we eat, and the houses we live in, and many, many other things. If you can sort of understand and connect with plants just a little bit more, you can sort of empathize with some of the issues that are going on right now, including the biodiversity crises and the climate crises, which are having detrimental effects on plant biodiversity and even just plant biomass, which have downstream, you know, effects on CO2 sequestration and oxygen production and many other things. So if you can learn about plants, appreciate plants, maybe you can sort of you know, empathize with them a bit more and become better stewards of the land, which can help combat those potential issues.
I agree. I think plants and maybe insects would be the other thing, that these are the sort of non-human components of the ecosystems that we live in, be it urban, suburban, or rural, that you really get to see and interact with all the time, right? Like, yeah, there's maybe a mountain lion out there, but good luck, you know, you're very lucky if you get to see it. Hopefully not too close, then you're unlucky. But, you know, it's really plants and insects, which are kind of underappreciated groups in general, I think. And if we're underappreciating the vast majority of non-human life that we get to see and interact with, then we're underappreciating our sort of position as living within a diverse ecosystem. And this is, I think, what we sort of mean when it's like, let's cultivate this understanding that we are members of diverse ecosystems, mm-hmm. which we both depend on and interact with all the time. Mm-hmm. And increase our awareness and curiosity of our place within them. And plants, because they're so ubiquitous, so diverse, and so crucial ecologically, are, we think, a pretty essential place to start. Insects are cool too.
Yeah.
But plants don't move. So you can.
It's true. Yeah. There's really great like opportunities to go up, and plants don't move and they only occasionally can hurt you. Right. And as long as you can identify it, you can avoid touching it and then it won't hurt you.
Yeah. Don't touch it first.
Yeah. The other thing that's really interesting that we've talked about a lot and and written about and are writing about is this idea that plants, unlike many other groups of organisms, like many animals that move, are great study systems for understanding aspects of evolution, right? Like you can walk, even just go to the grocery store, right? We have Brassica oleracea, right? We have one species that through human cultivation, we have, you know, essentially selected all this variation or selected upon all this variation. But even, you know, outside of that, you walk through a botanic garden and you have all these different cultivars or varieties of different species, and you can kind of see variation in real time, right? And that's so important for understanding evolution, because natural selection acts upon standing variation. And a lot of the times, you know, if you're not seeing this variation, you're like, oh, all maples look the same. They're all the same. This is an archetype maple. It has this leaf type, you know, it has this fruit type, it has this flower type. But it's like, no. Like, actually, look at this. Like, look at this leaf is a little oddly shaped. Look at this flower, maybe a little bigger or smaller or redder or pinker or whatever. So kind of seeing that is really important. The other thing is plants are really, because of the way they grow and develop, really robust to withstanding mutations. Like you could have a plant that, you know, has a weird mutation in its leaf where half of it is, you know, not producing chlorophyll, it's variegated, and the other half is green. And you know, that plant is probably going to do just fine. As opposed to if you had an animal, let's say, you know, a mountain lion, because Ben used that example, where, you know, maybe it had a mutation and two of its limbs didn't develop properly. Like that animal in nature is done. And you can't visualize that mutation in situ. So right. So you have variation, you have mutations, and those are like some of the foundations of evolution. And so you can kind of see that happen in real time. And of course, as we said, they don't move. So you can walk up to them and you can look at them. So they are truly a fantastic study system, like for the general public to understand evolution. And the other thing I will add is that they're less, I think, loaded in terms of talking about evolution, right? When we start talking about evolution in animals, it's a very small jump to talking about human evolution, which is kind of a stark place to start with for people who might not, you know much about evolution or want to believe in it. But if you kind of ease people in from this plant side of things, it's a much softer place to start and an engaging place.
Yeah, the you know, back to what Ben said about the plants in our, and you said it too, Jacob, in our everyday life. On more than one occasion, I've tried to imagine how I could go through a day where I'm not impacted by plants, or I don't use plants, or, you know, I don't wear plants, or I don't put plants into my car. It's literally runs through everything that we experience on a daily basis. Every human experiences that. And I think we might be hard pressed to find a bigger gap in something that we use on a daily basis, and, you know, even what we call it, what the name of it is, or, you know, what it looks like. And so all of, like, you know, the chia pet thing, like, there might be a huge disconnect between people knowing that chia seeds are a superfood and they were also the chia pet seeds. There's, you know, those little things that I think about on a daily basis. And, you know, all of us out there doing this sort of push on, you know, being aware of what's around you, the plants in your environment that you exist in, recognizing those and respecting them, and then giving them you know, room and, you know, trying to make their lives better over, you know, something that we may see as better, you know, shifting that perspective of putting, maybe putting plants first for, you know, once in however million years.
Yeah. I always go back to one of my favorite pieces of writing, which is Aldo Leopold talking about the land ethic, his idea of a land ethic, which advocates that we expand our definition of community beyond humans and human institutions to also include the non-human life and in our, that we interact with, you know, our non-human community as well as part of our community, and just advocates that we be good stewards, right? And not everyone in a community has the same motivations and incentives at any given time. And sometimes being a good steward means putting the betterment of others ahead of your own on occasion. And we would do well to think about that at many different scales, personal scales, but also I think institutional and government scales.
Yes.
Corporate scales, right? It's not, I think the thing to remember is, you know, it's really not the individual, especially with some of these climate crises, you know, it's not us individuals that are really the ones who are causing some of the biggest issues. It's larger corporations, who are run by individuals, right? But this is like, if you can get people, especially early on, in their life, maybe, and kind of keep that nugget of like fascination about plants or just, you know, empathy,
yeah, curiosity.
Right? Curiosity. There, then they might take it up with them when they become CEOs of large organizations and they're making big decisions on, yeah, you know, how do they want to run their businesses and whatnot.
Yeah. More that, CEOs with good houseplant collections that they're really attentive to and care about. We might be better off.
That would be really interesting. That would probably be better for the world. I was going to ask you, the biodiversity thing, you know, I just learned this recently when I was listening to a talk, but there, you know, and I was kind of surprised, and I feel like we as New Englanders have a little bit, we're a little spoiled in what we have access to in terms of like plant ID information. And I mean, like, a flora of our area. And it was really interesting to me that they said that Alabama doesn't have a flora at all. And that's one of the most biodiverse states in the country. But it also excites me because that's like, I want to take a trip to Alabama really soon and just look around and see what's there. Because that, to me, that's like where you would find really interesting things that nobody's really pieced it all together yet. And the other one was Virginia, I think, just got a new flora after over 150, 160 years, something like that. Mm. Just reassessed their statewide data and put it together where you could like figure that stuff out. Almost like we have that, the Haynes manual up here. But it's just it's an interesting thing that sort of all of the biodiversity is down south where there's the least amount of information being compiled together.
I personally,
you guys want to go to Alabama some we should do that.
I've been through because all of my field work for my PhD was in the southeastern US, and oh my gosh, I wish I had left more time because I was like running around trying to find my study species. But whenever I got a chance, I would be, you know, camping in a national forest or something and just oh my gosh, some of the most fun, beautiful places I've ever been. But it's an interesting point about the flora, and something I've thought about is I also really like birds and birding, and the birding community has such a rich history of really effective field guides. And sort of the idea of a field guide, I think, was really perfected by the birding community. Mm-hmm. But in my weaker moments, I think, man, can plants ever get there? Because the scale of the problem is just so different. You know, there's 11,000-ish species of birds period, globally. You know, there's that many species of grass or whatever. It's like the, yeah. the scale of the problem is tough for plants.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, certainly flora's got to exist, man. I wonder if there is a chicken and egg thing where it's like that problem is so daunting that fewer people go after it. But because people aren't going after it, it's not inspiring a new generation and informing a new generation to come up and make it better. And I wonder.
Right.
It's a fun problem to work on, though, in my opinion. We got to get more people thinking it's a fun problem to work on.
Yeah, because like, you know, the thing that is interesting is like, I mean, you can even extend that further south, right? And get into places like the tropics where, you know, you try to take something like iNaturalist or Seek into the field and you put it on a plant, like good luck. It's not going to get it. It's not, it's maybe yeah. we'll get like order, you know, or something like that. So it's, this, yeah, I think it's this issue of like biodiversity is daunting in terms of straight up alpha taxonomy and understanding what is there. But that's the type of work that's really important. And I think the other issue is a lot of this foundational work, which, you know, alpha taxonomy, for instance, which all of biology and other, you know, aspects of science and technology and engineering build on, it are sort of have recently not been appreciated. And not, you know, in so many cases funded. And that leads to this like cascading effect of, okay, well, if you're not going to fund or appreciate the work that we need to build this foundation, then you're sort of, you're going to have huge gaps in knowledge base at like a broad geographical level. Yeah.
Gaps, so, and also biases, right?
Yeah, for sure. So I think that, you know, that's another, I guess, issue is yeah, you know, we need to fund and appreciate foundational science because it is just that. It's the foundation.
How do we do that? I've heard so many people say that, you know, nobody ever makes money off like plant conservation. You know, like that's a pretty common mentality probably. So how do you, I don't think it would be hard to get people excited about, you know, going somewhere and like, we're going to survey the shit out of this state for the next 6 months. And like, I think there might be a huge group of people that would want to do that, but how do you, I guess it would have to be privately funded or I'm not sure.
Well,
right now it seems that way. I mean, first you hit all the military bases, which often protect a ton of land and need to know what lives there.
Yeah. Yeah.
But once you've covered those, I don't know.
I think
the government, you know, money tries it.
there's a couple, I think, answers to this. One of them is, I think, maybe a more cynical and corporate answer, which is a lot of places that want to build and develop need to survey the area and understand what plants and animals are there and if there are any endangered species or red listed things to make sure that they're not, you know, they don't get slapped with some fines, right? So people, surveyors and big companies, you know, pay a lot of money to like, to people like us to go and survey the land and make sure that it's not the habitat for a, you know, an endangered species or a protected species or something like that. But that's I think, you know, that's not the way we want to fund alpha, you know, taxonomy and understanding regional diversity. I think a lot of it is like zeitgeist, right? Like the sort of like the philosophy and the mentality of, I think, scientists. I think we're actually like the ones to kind of blame here, right? Because you have this like, you know, progress, right? Okay, we can sequence genomes now. We can sequence genomes of single cells in, you know, and then you're either and also on the flip side of that, we can look at the Earth from like, you know, so high up and look at things in pixels. So you're dissecting things down to the cellular and atomic level, and you're breaking the Earth up into pixels, and those are like essentially the two fields that you're pushing forward heavily as a group of scientists. And so you're inherently removing importance from other aspects of science, which are these like foundational ones. So I think a lot of it comes down to like, we have to, as a whole, understand and appreciate these foundational, you know, fields of science. How we get there, that's the question.
What about canceling NASA, the NASA program? Just take all of the funding that they get, put it into body programs.
Well, one thing is that these satellites are more and more being used for plant biology, like understanding forest ecosystem dynamics and stuff.
Right.
Oh, we can keep some of them. Let Elon. Right.
Maybe we can deal keep with Space satellites. Force. We can do fun space Space Force.
So you know, for somebody who's maybe interested in getting into plants for the first time, or you know, we talked about how overwhelming, you know, it could be for just for the general public to think about sort of creating these baseline of information. But for somebody, you know, listening to you guys, or just saw a house plant on some Instagram post that they really like, and they want to start getting into plants, the switch turned on in their head. How do they do that?
One thing I would say is don't feel like there's a right way to do it or a right place to start. If it's the houseplant you just bought, go learn as much as you can about the houseplant. You know, like just follow the paths that are interesting to you, because like we were talking about, there's so many plants that I don't think it's a good approach to be like, okay, time to learn all the plants. Like, let's start. You know, that's not going to happen. Right. So you just follow the tracks that are really interesting to you, and just naturally that will start to lead you to, oh, I didn't know this family existed, or, you know. One other thing I would say is, again, from the world of birding, there's such an emphasis on getting, when you see something in the wild, getting your ID to the species level. But I would suggest change your expectations for plants, and it can be just as exciting and rewarding and informative to some degree to get to genus or even to family. Family is like one of the taxonomic levels that botanists often focus on. So trying to learn characteristics of plant families is a less daunting place to start. And you can go deeper on your favorite families, or, you know, you can go from there. But there's so much diversity, which is one of the most exciting things about plants and one of the craziest, most daunting things about them. So it's, yeah, don't expect it to be like birding, right? You're going to get to species every time. I'm super excited if I get to genus, right? I'm seeing something. Oh, what is that? Like, let's try to figure it out.
And that's sort of like what kind of bring it back to the Everglades. That's what we teach our students, right? It's like, you know, this is your algorithm for getting from, okay, I walked up to a plant, and then work your way down. You know, what part of the phylogeny or evolutionary tree are we in? What order is it? What family is it? And then once you get there, a lot of the times we stop there. We're like, this is great. Family, perfect. Especially, and that's where like this idea of, if you know what to look for and you know what your algorithm is, you can be plopped anywhere, almost anywhere in the world, and, you know, get somewhere, maybe order, or maybe like large group, right? But yeah, you know, the funny thing is that with that question you asked, I feel like, you know, with Ben and I, our mission is like, we think so heavily about the four, like, part of that. So like, until they catch the bug, and then once they catch the bug, it's like, okay, like, yay, we did it. So we kind of focus like so heavily on this part, right, that we like, yeah, I don't think we, you know, we don't really think too much about,
yeah, this is a nice prompt though. I like this. Okay, one other thing that just occurred to me is we, Jacob and I, tend to use a lot of vocab, and one of the things that we try to do in our videos is introduce interesting vocab words when we think they're helpful or might help you remember some interesting feature. But there's definitely no need to learn this vocab to get interested in plants. I think you can observe these plant structures closely and enjoy that and come up with your own systems for describing what you're seeing or understanding what you're seeing. And if you're curious on following up, then that probably involves learning some amount of vocab, because it exists so that people who are thinking all day and night about these things can have a shared language to communicate about them. But you'll be able to make connections between the stuff you've observed and the way you've just been describing it with how other people are describing it. But you definitely don't need to start there. I would hate for that to be a barrier.
Yeah.
Plants just look really beautiful. So, you know.
Yeah. And two other things. One, to Ben's point about like, oh, like, you know, once you get the bug and you like get your house plant, like dive deeper, you don't have to. You could stop there. If you can like see the benefits of plants and like you empathize with the cause, you know, and like, yeah, that's fine. You're good. Like, whatever. But the other thing, I guess, if we can kind of take a step back to like that beginning part that we tend to think a lot about, I think what Ben and I tried to do, you know, and you kind of fall into this issue with, let's just take an intro bio class, right? In the classroom or even outside, where people are like, oh, plants are boring. Like, I don't want to study plants. Animals are more interesting. And I think that foundation actually sets up a really nice, way to get people even more interested in it, because they're coming from this place of, oh, they're boring. Okay, let me show you plants that move. Let me show you plants that eat other plants. Let me show you plants that shoot their seeds or their spores, you know, 100 miles an hour, right? Faster than almost any thing in the animal world, right? Like let me show you this complete juxtaposition based on what you think is the reality versus like what is the reality. And sometimes that, oh my God, I never realized that factor can be really strong. And that's kind of how, what we tend to focus on with this, you know, with this part of that trajectory, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I think, you know, I actually went to school for wildlife biology and I didn't want to do it at all. I was like, I had to pick something and botany wasn't an option. So I knew I wanted to be in that realm, and that was like the closest I could get. And so I just went through all the wildlife biology courses just to like get my degree, but I was always doing plants on the side, you know, doing other things that were getting me all the information I was craving about, you know, the surroundings. And you hardly ever see animals out in the woods. You know, to me, the plants were the most interesting thing. And I wanted to be able to like look at the ground and know what I was looking at and have a sense of, you know, what was going on there, because it seemed up until that point that every, you know, once I started learning the differences, I was like, oh, this is way more intense than I thought it was. You know, there's right here.
Yeah.
And it's always kind of like a treasure hunt, because you never know what you're going to find. There could be something right around the corner, different little habitat, you know, and then you get to like play that whole puzzle out in your head about how things work and how these species interact on different levels. And
yeah, that's awesome.
I wish it was a bug you could just give to everybody and we could all just have it.
Mm-hmm. I love hearing about your experience as a student, because this is how a lot of people think of plants, is exactly how you were not thinking of plants, is, okay, this is the stage. When are the actors going to show up? You know, when are the animals going to come on stage?
Yeah.
Whereas you realized, no, there's already actors here. You know, there's plenty of stuff to focus on that we shouldn't just regard as the stage.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's this, you know, there's this phenomenon that many people have written about called plant awareness disparity, historically called plant blindness, but we're trying to move away from that term as it's a sort of ableist. Yeah. It's this idea of like, you know, yeah, like Ben said, we see plants as the background to ecosystems, right? And you sort of have this like, you know, if you know, when you squint your eyes and look outside, right? Like it's all fuzzy. So if we can like kind of like turn those dials and focus, right? Turn the focus to sort of bring everything into a bit of a finer view, right? Like that's kind of our goal.
Yeah, everyone knows there's plants out there, but you could be focusing in on those, you know.
The other thing, you know, is what you brought up about the, you know, you didn't have a botany department or a botany major, and or plant biology, right? This is very common in at least the US, is like plant specific departments and plant specific majors over the last, I don't know, 30 years or so have started to be just clumped with other majors like general bio or zoology or whatnot. And so you kind of lose that specificity. And there are a couple places, you know, there are a good number of botany degrees out there. You know, my alma mater at the University of Vermont, there's a plant biology department, and you know, there was a plant biology major, and so like they're out there, but they're definitely getting clumped, and that I think is one potential issue for sure.
Part of it's got to be because of, you know, part of it's funding, and the funding is going into like. Mm-hmm. Medical programs, pharmaceutical stuff, probably because that's where a lot of that money is, you know, coming from for those programs. So that gets back to the point before about, you know, where's the money going to come from to like fund the plant biology programs at these schools? Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that you guys talked about goals. So for Let's Botanize, what's the, do you guys have any foreseeable goals in the next like year or two or three?
That's a good question. I mean,
you just to the moon, just.
I mean, I think our goal, I think, you know, our mission is our mission, and to achieve that mission, I think we need to be reaching as many people as possible. Right. So doing things like this, or right, being on your podcast and collaborating with people, which we're always up to do, and just kind of expanding our reach. I think just by doing that and continuing to do what we're doing and innovating where and changing where we see appropriate, is kind of our goal. So like just expand and reach more people and spread the bug, as you put it. So
yeah. And a sort of meta goal is always be evaluating how we're doing this and trying to get better at it ourselves. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we're just trying to get in front of eyeballs and get people curious about plants. It's a little hard to evaluate. Maybe one thing we could try to focus on is like having some ways of measuring or assessing, like, yeah, people are watching these. Are they getting more curious about plants? I hope so.
Yeah.
When people leave comments, that's really helpful because it feels like, oh, they're going to go look for a skunk cabbage now. Or right. Something.
Yeah. One thing that we're pretty good at is sort of documenting our growth and our demographics, and things like that, which a lot of these apps are really, you know, or some are better than others at. Yeah, I think that's kind of one way we do it. The other way is, as Ben kind of alluded to, looking at the comments, and we've kind of played with ideas of like, okay, I mean, they're also subjective, that it's like, how do you assess your impact by looking at a bunch of different subjective comments across a bunch of different, there's no sort of standardization, right? I think assessing impact is important, but we're still trying to figure out ways to do that for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think you guys are doing a pretty good job. You know, I think it's really important that you're thinking about the language that you're using just in terms of terminology and stuff, because it is the botanical, you know, dictionary is
fast.
It is like a different different language, and some, you know, sometimes families have their own separate language that,
oh yeah, yeah, we could so be out there being like glooms and polycyclic steels and
yeah, and I think that's, you know, when everyone would just glaze over, and
yeah,
you know, I think that's probably what they've been fed, at least some degree of that, you know, that technical, this is too technical for anyone to actually understand. So I think what you guys are doing is really important.
Thank you.
The other thing is, you know, as we said, our goal is to sort of get in front of, I think Ben said it, as many eyeballs as possible. And we started off on Instagram, and YouTube, and we were a little reluctant at first to get onto TikTok because we didn't know much about it. You know, we're not the youngest folks, but we're not that old, yeah. When we finally like made that shift, we were like, oh, you know, there's something about the algorithm that really puts us in front of a lot more people. And also it was like the most downloaded app, I think, in the last year, which is bonkers. Yeah. So you know, kind of not being afraid of like changing things up and like diving into different things, like what's the new thing that we can, you know, how can we reach more people? That's kind of where our meta minds are at.
Have you guys done a TikTok dance yet?
we have. So this is the thing that we've, you know, talked about a lot. Like, what's our tone? And we joke here and there. You know, we have some silly things in some videos. And we have a lot of bloopers. Ben has done a pretty good job at adding those into some of it. And yeah, so maybe we'll tease you all with a blooper video, a full blooper video to come. But no, I think we want to kind of keep our tone, you know, like serious, but like humble and not too like, you know,
yeah, up in we're the, pretty up nerdy. Yeah. We're not going to pretend that we're not nerdy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Would, one thing that would probably blow up your TikTok is if you brought the mustache back.
I'm always, thank you for saying that, because we'll get them.
I have some, you know, some big events coming up, you know, just interviews and presentations and you know, seminars. So I feel like I'm just kidding.
I think a mustache might do the trick though.
Maybe
when it's all done and you don't have to do that stuff anymore.
Yeah. I think that's, yeah,
that's how you know as an audience.
I think it's a summer thing too. I'm sure, I don't know if you have a beard, but I don't know if you've ever gone with a mustache, but it's kind of, it feels like a summer thing.
Yeah, no, it is. I usually take it off in the summer. It's not anymore.
Mm-hmm. Great. Beautiful. Thank you so much. This is really lovely to just chat.
It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Next time I'm down that way, I'll look you guys up and we should go on a plant walk or something.
We'd love to. Always down to do that.
We'll do Let's Botanize in person.
Yeah.
We can sync it up perfectly.
All right, guys. Well, thank you so much. And I hope you have a good weekend.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
You too.
We'll see you later.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's botanize.
Okay. Let's do it again.
Let's botanize. Oh, God.
Let's botanize.
I missed it. All right. Give me one more shot. Or like, let's do 1, 2, 3 and what would be 4, you know, like 1, the next beat in the sequence.
We'll okay. All right.
We got it this time. We got it.
Let's botanize.
Wait. You guys lead it in because you're in the same space. So
let's botanize.
Nice.
That's good. That's good. I'll make it work.
Thanks for listening, everybody. I am going to be taking a little break from doing any shows on the podcast. So this will be the last one for a little bit until May 1st. Hope you've been enjoying everything. Thanks to the Let's Botanize crew, Ben and Jacob, for coming on the show. Really loved having them on. I put in the outtakes, even though I told them I wouldn't, because they make me laugh every time I listen to them. It was very complicated to get to line all that thing out, but we eventually troubleshooted it and got it to work. So, season 2 will start up May 1st. We'll have some new adventures, new plants, new people, talking about plants, new places. It'll be full-blown spring in Vermont, so we'll have some spring ephemerals to talk about and hopefully some new stuff to keep the botanical information flowing. So hope you guys are doing well, and I'll see you May 1st.